Vanderbilt University political scientist Mark Hetherington does not believe that the left and right in politics are coming together. Mark is the co-author of the book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. Recently, I spoke with Mark about the research behind this book and why he co-wrote it.
Well, Emery, I think there are two different things that I really wanted to accomplish. One of them was about just real-world politics, and one of them was sort of more scholarly. I'll start with the scholarly part of it first. You know, oddly speaking, we have sort of a scholarly tradition developing that suggests that, at least among ordinary people, that we're not polarized. That's kind of the way scholars, you know, have seen it and you know, use various levels of public opinion data to show this. And, you know, for me, just with the experiences that I've had talking with people, watching people, I feel like that doesn't really capture the reality of things. We are, you know, in certain ways polarized, even if, you know, say, you know, we don't seem a million miles apart on the issues. That is, we being Democrats on one side and Republicans on the other. And what I set out looking for was some explanation for, well, if it is true that we're not miles apart on the issues, what are we divided about that causes us to, you know, develop this, you know, kind of tension between us? And so this book was an effort to try to answer that question. From a practical politics perspective, you know, I come from a family that, you know, is steeped in politics. You know, my dad was a longtime Republican political operative in Pennsylvania. And I really feel like in talking with him, you know, he feels like his party has changed in ways that he's not particularly comfortable with. And this effort was also a way to try to figure out, you know, in a sense, why do people who think of themselves as economic conservatives, why do they feel uncomfortable in their party? And on the other side of the divide, why do people who are sort of longtime labor liberals feel like the party really doesn't speak to them any longer? And I think that this book answers some of those questions, too.
Is what you're saying that the political landscape has changed since the baby boomers were growing up?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that is so clear from the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, into the 1960s, when the baby boomers were sort of coming of age politically, the economic conditions of the country and, you know, how big people thought the government ought to be and what role the government ought to be and play in helping people out. That's what divided Republicans from Democrats and liberals from conservatives. As time's gone by, different types of issues that are more kind of visceral in nature, things that, you know, are more in our guts than in our heads, have come to divide us. So it's not so much the economic divide alone any longer. Adding to that divide, you know, extending that divide and sorting people in different ways is issues that started in the 1960s, late 1960s, with racial politics and the notion of law and order. And then in the 1970s and early 1980s, with the rise of feminism and the proper response to the Soviet Union, keeping us safe, you know, in that sense. And then into the 1990s and the 2000s, we've seen, you know, the rise of gay rights, and we've seen immigration become an important issue, and protection from terrorism. These things divide us in ways that are different from, you know, whether the government ought to provide certain services or not provide certain services. Instead, you know, these things are much more visceral, heartfelt issues, and that's changed the political divide between Republicans and Democrats and liberals and conservatives quite fundamentally.
Would you say that someone like Barry Goldwater was one of the early politicians to get people kind of, you know, really enthusiastic on some of the more conservative issues?
Yes and no. You know, Barry Goldwater was a principled conservative who really felt like the government just shouldn't be involved in certain things. You know, his opposition to civil rights was very much a principled stand against you know, the federal government being involved in the integration of, you know, schools or the integration of services in places that local authorities didn't think it was best to occur in. But the interesting thing is, you know, although Goldwater himself may have been what you might refer to as just a small government conservative, his politics disproportionately appealed to people who thought about race, not necessarily about the size of government. You know, when you think about the states that Goldwater won, other than his native Arizona, they were all Deep South states. And his election in 1964, you know, is really the start of the revamping of the political map where, you know, the solid Democratic South, you know, there were no Southern members, well, barely any Southern members of the Republican delegation in House and Senate. But now overwhelming majorities of senators are Republicans from the southern states, and a majority of southern House members are Republicans. So Goldwater is an important figure in this, but not Goldwater himself. It's what the politics that evolved after his candidacy. Those are the politics that are important.
So when we look at groups today like the so-called teabaggers that are perceived as being to the far right, is this what's happened along the way, that now we're all the way over there? You know, we were at one point with Goldwater and it's kept moving to the right.
Well, and I think it's interesting. I think that the anti-healthcare movement, you know, the teabaggers, the Tea Party folks are an embodiment of this new politics of the right. But the interesting thing about them is, you know, it seems to me anyway, from watching their rhetoric and the way that they talk about politics, you know, I don't know whether, you know, the objection is really, you know, a well thought out, you know, based on the facts set of concerns about politics. And one of the things that we find in our research is that, you know, even though a lot of the argument made by people on the political right, especially this far right, the teabagging movement or the Tea Party movement, you know, may be about, oh, you know, we don't want socialism, we don't want government run programs. What we're finding actually is, especially with an African-American president, that people's preferences on these issues that you wouldn't think, you know, would be tinged with racial attitudes actually are. And, you know, our sense is that, you know, this politics that I described, you know, post-Goldwater 1960s, 1970s, you know, these visceral issues are now even kind of infecting the issues that we wouldn't necessarily think as issues that would be racialized or, you know, to use the term that we use in our book, you know, would be attractive to people who score relatively high in authoritarianism. One thing that I want to point out, too, is it's not just the right that's moving to the right. One of the things that we find is that the left is very much moving to the left, especially among political elites. What we have now is a very conservative Republican Party in Congress and a very liberal Democratic Party in Congress. And we have a public that is, you know, for the most part, at least on their issue positions, you know, much more moderate as it relates to these things. And I think that's one of the reasons we see the dissatisfaction with politics right now.
How do you define the word authoritarianism? Are you talking about somebody that feels like he or she has a lot of authority?
No. And that's a great question. You know, we're sort of, you know, as people writing in the time that we're writing, saddled with, you know, these terms that psychologists and sociologists have used over the last number of decades to describe a certain type of a person. When we talk about authoritarianism or authoritarians, what we're talking about is people who, you know, answer survey questions in such a way that suggests that they need a lot of order in their lives. People who score high in authoritarianism probably have extraordinarily well-kept desks. They probably don't leave the house without cleaning up on the way out. People who score low in authoritarianism are probably people who have desks that are a mess and have no problem going out with you know, clothes on the floor and dishes in the sink. So a need for order is central to this understanding of authoritarianism. But one of the things that's interesting about that is, you know, these, you know, sort of deeply seated psychological characteristics that people have also seem to have a big impact on their attitudes about things that touch on politics. So people that score high in authoritarianism tend to have much more conservative positions on things like gay rights, on race, on immigration. They tend to be much more muscular in their preferences for how to deal with terrorism, or, you know, before that, how to deal with the Soviet threat. So all of these positions on these political issues, you know, seem to have at their base, you know, this almost innate difference in terms of a desire for order, a need for order, the desire to, you know, follow different traditions. And when we have a politics that's divided along those lines, you know, I think that what that suggests is, you know, we have real potential for the one side not really being able to see and understand the perspective of the other side. Hence, compromise is very difficult to find.
You also found that parents in their parenting style that reflects their level of authoritarianism?
Well, that's the way we measure it. And you know, it's funny. When I started this process of trying to identify what makes ordinary Republicans and ordinary Democrats not be able to understand one another, I didn't have the term authoritarianism in mind. But there are these survey measures that people have developed over the course of years that ask people what their preferences are for characteristics in kids. You know, so they ask, you know, here are two sets of alternatives that we probably all want our kids to have. You know, one of them might be respect for elders and the other one might be independence. And they ask people to choose between the two. And the people that choose things like respect for elders and obedience and good manners are people who score high in authoritarianism. People who say things like independence and self-reliance and
speaking out for yourself.
Yeah, caring about other people. Those are the types of people who score low in authoritarianism. And frankly, you know, even leaving the term authoritarianism aside, which I'd frankly like to do, these values that you would like in kids, a fundamental understanding of right and wrong, you know, what would you want your kids to be? You know, in a sense, I think it's a question of whether you'd want your kids to be coached by Bobby Knight if they were a basketball player, or Dean Smith, you know, the legendary coach at North Carolina. This seems to determine political preferences in certain ways. And frankly, I think that's just, you know, very, very interesting in and of itself.
Looking at some of our most visible politicians right now, would you say that authoritarianism had much to do with the outcome of the 2008 election?
Well, I think it did. And it's funny. One of the things that we have a tendency to do is to focus on, you know, people who score high in authoritarianism because, you know, they're supposed to be these, you know, at least according to literature, these, you know, kind of problematic characters, the folks who we would be concerned about following an Adolf Hitler or a Joseph Stalin or somebody like that. That's not what we're talking about at all. But the interesting thing is, you know, this focus on them leads us away from thinking about the other side of the divide, that is the non-authoritarians. And, you know, if we think about authoritarians as people who need order and discipline and all of those types of things, the other side of the divide are maybe people who think about the world less in hierarchical terms, more in horizontal terms, you know, who might favor rhetoric and, you know, a lot of thinking in terms of rather than instinct and action. And Barack Obama, and I think in a lot of ways, really embodies that. You know, here's this, you know, very different guy, you know, from, you know, what people have described as an exotic background. I think that's very attractive to people who score low in authoritarianism. You know, he's this real, you know, sort of ruminator, you know, this whole notion of, oh, what to do about Afghanistan. But it's something that conservatives view as dithering. I think it's actually something that people who score low in authoritarianism think of as, you know, a really important process in reaching the right decision. So, you know, his type of politics, you know, and of course, you know, he is, you know, of a different race from, you know, the dominant race. All of these types of things, I think, make him, and of course, he also embraces multilateralism as opposed to unilateralism as far as foreign policy is concerned. So one of the manifestations of this that we see in the voting data is that Democrats did surprisingly well among – they always do well among people with graduate degrees, but they did overwhelmingly well with people with graduate degrees. They usually get beaten relatively soundly by people with college degrees, but Obama actually split the college degree vote with McCain in 2004. So we're seeing this evolution, and of course, the people who score low in authoritarianism tend to be higher educated than people who score low. So, you know, we see, you know, this type of a change going on. My sense is that had the economic situation been a little rosier, people who score high in authoritarianism would have found McCain and especially Sarah Palin, somebody who was particularly attractive to sort of low education, rural people, would have been even more strong than it was. But when the economy is bad, you know, sometimes people who are toward the bottom of the economic ladder, as people who score high in authoritarianism tend to be, they don't feel like they can vote on these, you know, sort of different values issues because the economic concerns are at the top of their list. So maybe they voted Democratic this time, but in a time that there was less economic threat, I have a feeling the divide might have been even steeper.
So you're saying
that Obama had a big appeal to the non-authoritarians,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
And also compared to Hillary Clinton, was that the case also?
It really was. And this is one of the things that's, I think, really interesting about the book. You know, some people might think about this, oh, boy, you know, you're calling Republicans authoritarians. And you know, we're really not. What we're saying is it's not that all Republicans are score high in authoritarianism. It's just that more authoritarians tend to be gravitating toward the Republican Party these days. But there are still plenty of people who score low in authoritarianism who are low in authoritarianism. And the same is actually true on the Democratic side. There's just more sorting going on there. But what we found in our primary data was that people who scored high in authoritarianism who participated in the Democratic primary were overwhelmingly likely to back Hillary Clinton, and people who scored low were incredibly likely to choose Barack Obama. Oftentimes, the news media said, well, you know, it's people who are low in education, working class whites who, you know, feel more comfortable with Clinton. And that was true in a lot of states. But, you know, the interesting – and so, you know, the places that we think about are places like West Virginia and Kentucky and places like that where Obama did particularly poorly and Clinton did particularly well, you know, but there was no, you know, African-American population to speak of. But, you know, take West Virginia, which last I checked is right next to Virginia. Low education people in Virginia actually tended to, you know, split their votes much more evenly between Obama and Clinton. But it's a population that tends to score lower in authoritarianism on average than those do in West Virginia. You go out to Oregon too. You know, people who go out in Oregon, you know, it's a different type of a population than the types of people that you're likely to find in Appalachia, whether they're low education or high education. Low education people in Oregon actually tend to be much lower in authoritarianism than people who are low education in West Virginia. You know, there's something that's moved them out there, something that's probably part of their personality that caused them to leave, you know, a given place. And so we saw Obama doing particularly well, even with low education people out there. So it wasn't so much an education divide that we saw in the primaries. What it really was an authoritarianism divide, even within the Democratic Party.
Is there any explanation in connection with your book about why Obama seems to be losing more of the independent voters now?
You know, and our book wouldn't necessarily speak to that, but I think that the situation right now is not necessarily all that surprising. Presidents over the course of time tend to lose support, especially during bad economic times, and that loss of support is going to happen disproportionately among independents. So Republican partisans don't like Obama to begin with. So there's very little Republican support he can lose, you know, right from the beginning, especially in this sort of polarized time. Democrats are going to be slow to move away from him because they're Democrats. You know, liberals, you know, keep complaining about, you know, he's not liberal enough. But, you know, where are they going to go? You know, they're going to remain relatively loyal to him. So when you know, I frankly think the most interesting parallel between Obama and another president is actually President Reagan, oddly enough, because one is very conservative, one is quite liberal. But Ronald Reagan took office from Jimmy Carter during a really challenging economic downturn. And he was not popular for, you know, much of the first 2 years of his presidency. The Republicans absorbed pretty, you know, tough losses in the midterm elections in 1982. And it really wasn't until late 1983, 1984, when we started to think of Ronald Reagan as someone who might succeed. And I have a feeling it's going to be a tough 2009. Well, it's been a tough 2009. It's going to be a tough 2010 for Obama. I think they'll lose a bunch of seats in the House and Senate. And, you know, if you're an Obama supporter, you hope that the economy turns around and independents start to think, oh, yeah, this is why I elected him. But if it doesn't, it could be a tough 2012, too.
Does that message, I guess, offer perhaps some hope to people that from the Republican Party that want to take on Obama in 2012?
It could, you know, and but it's one of those things that, you know, it's going to be tough for the Republicans to find the right person, or so it seems. One of the things that I think is interesting about 2008 is just how weak the field of Republican challengers turned out to be. And this is what happens when a party, you know, has been in power for a really long time. You know, this era, I think, really started with Ronald Reagan in 1980, and it's been a dominant Republican era. It took a while for the because of structural reasons for the Republicans to take over House and Senate. But even in the 80s, it was a conservative-leaning government, and it has been really for a long time. But when a party has been ascendant for decades, oftentimes the talent pool gets pretty shallow. And I think that's what we saw in 2008. And frankly, it's unclear, you know, who that next great Republican is going to be that's going to redefine who the party is. And hopefully, if you're on the Republican side of things, you know, this economic unease that people are seeing is going to be the crucible that the next great Republican candidate is formed in. But right now, it's not entirely clear who that next candidate is.
Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics has been published by Cambridge University Press. For Interview, I'm Ibrahim Deer Owens.